Hello, everyone. Good to see you all. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Don. How are you?
I'm doing well. Is it still raining there?
No, it has tapered off, and it's not expected to get any worse as the day goes on.
Oh, good, good, good. Okay, good.
Okay. And you're a co-host now, so you are
wonderful.
At control.
Okay, thanks so much, Donna. Welcome, everyone, to our second class in the series of Uniting Wisdom and Compassion. Let's go ahead and start with the prayers that I generally do before most of my classes, starting with the praise to Shakyamuni Buddha. So as we do this praise, it's not that the Buddha needs our praise. It's that we are trying to align ourselves with the Buddha, with all the holy beings, our gurus, by admiring their qualities and also thinking about how each of us has the potential to achieve these same qualities, accomplish all of these results that we are praising in the Buddha. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. Let's do the short mandala offering. Just do this in English, visualizing a vast pure offering that we're making to all of our gurus, all the holy beings, so that we can receive their inspiration and blessings. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. Then refuge in bodhicitta before the teaching. As usual, we'll do this first time in English and then the other two in Tibetan, bringing to mind these two thoughts, and we'll meditate on bodhicitta shortly, but developing that sincere, safe direction that we find in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the three jewels of refuge, and then cultivating the motivation of bodhicitta for being here tonight. I go for refuge until I am enlightened. To the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, by the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye Chodang Soki Choknam La Jangchu Bardu Dakni Kyabsu Chi Daki Chanyan Gipe Sanam Gi Dola Penchir Sangye Drupar Shog Sangye Chodang Soki Choknam La Jangchu Bardu Dakni Kyabsu Chi Daki Chanyan Gipe Sanam Gi Dola Penchir Sangye Drupar Shog. Okay, good. Then let's do a short meditation. So we'll start off with just focusing on the breath. No doubt you have a technique you already use with the breath, so you can do that for the next few minutes. Try to keep your awareness with the breath as best as you can. Whenever the mind wanders, just gently guide the mind back to the breath. And then after a few minutes in silent meditation, I'll come in and lead you in a short reflection on compassion based on a little bit of what we talked about last week, and then moving that compassion into bodhicitta motivation. So now let's set our motivation of bodhicitta. And as I mentioned, we'll contemplate compassion in terms of the three types of suffering that we examined last week, the very end of class. And we're quite familiar with these, most of us, but it is important that we recall the extent to which beings are suffering, are in this unsatisfactory state. As we go through this, certainly reflect on your own experience with these, but then try to enlarge your concern, your empathy, by thinking about the fact that all beings in samsara are dealing with all three of these at one time or another. So first we have the suffering of pain, the manifest suffering, the more evident form of suffering. We know our own experiences with this when we've been sick, when we've been parted from the things we enjoy, that we love, and we've had to face the difficult things in life. This is a reality for so many beings, some of them suffering in that way and even to an even greater degree than what we ourselves are right now. But just let your heart open with compassion, with not just, again, a wish that these beings not experience that suffering, but try to increase it to great compassion, where we have the attitude of taking responsibility protecting these beings from that form of suffering. So just spend a short time reflecting on the suffering of pain and generating compassion for other beings wanting to remove their suffering. And then we can reflect upon the subtler form of suffering we call the suffering or dukkha of change. And this is the reality that even when beings experience pleasure, when they have those moments that they identify as happiness, those aren't true happiness. They aren't something that ultimately satisfies. And instead, things change. Those moments of pleasure are over, and if we were to try to sustain those experiences of pleasure, they would turn into pain eventually. This shows that they have an unsatisfactory nature. So this should break our hearts even more when we look at sentient beings and recognize that they go chasing after pleasure, but what they are chasing after isn't really satisfactory. It doesn't really do the trick. It doesn't help them to have what they ideally seek. So here to generate compassion, and not just the compassion that doesn't want them to experience that suffering, but the compassion that wants to protect them from that suffering, the great compassion. And the subtlest form of dukkha or suffering, pervasive conditioned suffering, the fact that every single being that is not yet free from karma and delusions is under the control of those factors and is thereby subject to the other types of suffering. This is 24/7 suffering. This is the reality of existence for all the beings in samsara. They've never known one moment of freedom, one moment of not being under the control of these factors. Just really reflect on how profound that level of suffering is, because it's what keeps them from experiencing the bliss of liberation and also the bliss of enlightenment. As long as they are in that state, they'll never know true freedom. So here to generate compassion, and especially the great compassion that looks upon those beings and wants to free them from that suffering, become the agent of protecting them from pervasive conditioned suffering and all forms of suffering. And then to move this into bodhicitta, we ask ourselves the question, but how can I do this right now? I can't even free myself from my own suffering, much less free all of these beings. Therefore, I have to become more qualified. I have to develop my own capability. Therefore, I have to become a Buddha. And so we generate bodhicitta, which is the wish for our own enlightenment, so that we can help others to the greatest degree, bring them to liberation, but moreover, bring them to enlightenment, complete Buddhahood. And it's for this reason that we are gathered together tonight to continue our exploration of this topic of uniting wisdom and compassion. So try to hold that motivation of bodhicitta very deeply in your heart. Good. Again, welcome to our second class. In the first class, we went through some introductory topics. Let me just put that on the screen. I did have a little course outline that I had provided that sort of shows, let's recite that after this. Let's go ahead and go through just really briefly what I went through last week. Last week was pretty much everything under this first point, the introduction to the text and some background to the text. We talked about the Buddha himself, of course, and the way that he taught in a variety of disciplines for various people who come from different predispositions. And so there's the Hinayana and the Mahayana are normally identified as the two main branches of the Buddha's teachings. They're not completely distinct because within the Mahayana are the Hinayana teachings, and the Hinayana are a bridge that will lead one eventually to the Mahayana teachings. So again, these are mostly contingent in terms of our practice on whether we seek individual liberation or whether we seek Buddhahood, which is the goal of the Mahayana. Individual liberation, the goal of the Hinayana. But again, we also have tenet systems that are geared around those two branches of the Buddhist teachings. And what we're going to be looking at in this course is mostly the tenets of Prasangika Madhyamaka, the consequence middle way school, which is said to be the final point of view of the Buddhist teachings. And so in all of the Buddhist tenet systems, on that third bullet point, there are what are called the three vehicles. And I won't talk so much about that because that's where we're going to start tonight, is actually getting into talking about two of those three vehicles that are Hinayana practitioners and then the Bodhisattva vehicle that is for the Mahayana. Then all the rest of this is pretty much looking at the background to this text, Nagarjuna, who came after the Buddha and expounded upon the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras and really delineated the middle way, the Madhyamika. And then Chandrakirti, the author of the text that we have the root verses for, who elaborated on Nagarjuna's commentary, his text, and provided a supplement to it. And then Tsongkhapa, whose commentary we're actually using, Tsongkhapa being the founder of the Gelug tradition in Tibetan Buddhism. And then we'll also be occasionally looking at Jitsunpa. Jitsunpa is a textbook writer for Sarajay Monastery. So anyway, just know that these are the people that whose names may come up here and there. Chandrakirti's text, again, elaborates on Nagarjuna's in terms of the vast, meaning the bodhisattva practices that lead to enlightenment, as well as the profound, the teachings on emptiness that we will be touching on as part of this course. That's kind of the wisdom side of it when we talk about uniting wisdom and compassion. And the structure of it, I won't go into that so much, but essentially this beginning part is talking about what leads one into the Mahayana, into becoming a bodhisattva, and compassion being the root of that. So we looked a little bit at compassion and really understood the nature of it. And what we're talking about here once more is great compassion, the compassion that not only observes the suffering of others and wants it to end, but takes responsibility for that, what we were meditating on in the motivation tonight. So what I'd like to do, I'll do this for all three of these classes remaining, is to recite the few verses from Chandrakirti that we are going to be working with. And so we become a little more familiar with them. Again, these are part of what he calls his homage to great compassion. So let's go ahead and read those tonight. Hearers and middling realizers of suchness are born from the kings of subduers. Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. The mind of compassion, non-dual understanding, and the altruistic mind of enlightenment are the causes of children of conquerors. Mercy alone is seen as the seed of a conqueror's rich harvest, as water for development, and as ripening in a state of long enjoyment. Therefore, at the start, I praise compassion. Homage to that compassion for migrators who are powerless like a bucket traveling in a well, through initially adhering to a self, an I, and then generating attachment for things. This is mine. Homage to that compassion for migrators seen as evanescent and empty of inherent existence, like a moon in rippling water. So what we're going to be doing tonight, we'll move into the next part of the outline, which again, there's the rest of the course is essentially going through those verses and the commentary on them that we, the verses we just recited. Tonight, we'll hopefully get to at least the first two bullet points there, A and B, as well as perhaps some of C, if not all of it, talk a bit about this little chain of causal processes that are involved in creating all the various virtuous results of the Buddhist path. So what we're going to be working with, again, is this text, by Lama Tsongkhapa. As I mentioned, this has been translated recently by Thupten Jinpa. The translation we're using, though, comes from Jeffrey Hopkins in a book that was called Compassion in Tibetan Buddhism that's now out of print. But this is the version of it that we used when I studied this text in the master's program. And recall that, again, this is the same text that they use in the Gluk monasteries when they study this, which is the main source of the middle way teachings, the emptiness teachings, because that is the bulk of Chandrakirti's text. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. So we're starting with an outline here. I just want to point this out because people may wonder, what is this 3A and 3A1 and what have you? These are what are called hierarchical outlines. And most of the commentaries, the treatises, are all divided into that. So we essentially have some main outlines. And in this case, we're in the third of the main outlines. That's why 3 is first. And then we're in the first outline within 3, which is 3A, which is the expression of worship. 3B goes on to the actual exposition of the 10 grounds and all the things I mentioned last week that are a part of the main body of the text. So within 3A, the expression of worship, we see that there are two parts. The praise of great compassion without differentiating its types, without getting into the three types of compassion that are the main topic of this course. And then homage to compassion within differentiating the three types. So within the first one, without differentiating its types, that's 3A1, because again, it's the first outline within 3A. And anyway, this is the way that we did it in the master's program so that we would know where we're at any point in terms of the main outline or what section we're in, what have you. So let's go ahead and begin by going through Lama Tsongkhapa's text and his commentary on Chandrakirti. He says, the Honorable Chandrakirti, having assumed the task of making a supplement to Nagarjuna's treatise on the middle way, does not state as his object of worship the hearers and solitary realizers who are taken as objects of worship in other books. Furthermore, he indicates that, rather than praising Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, it is suitable to praise great compassion, the most excellent cause of Buddhahood, bearing the nature of thoroughly protecting all vulnerable sentient beings bound in the prison of psychic existence. It is also the main cause, called by the name of its effect, the Blessed One, Bhagavati. So let me comment just a little bit on this because I think it's pretty evident. Essentially, you know, Chandrakirti is stepping away from tradition perhaps by not praising these holy beings, the hearers and solitary realizers, especially those who have accomplished their path, the arhats, the foe destroyers, as well as the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, Bodhisattvas who are aiming for Buddhahood, the Buddhas who have actually attained that. All these great beings are certainly worthy of praise, but he goes for a praise of great compassion because as we're going to see in this first part, what we look at tonight, compassion is seen as the root of all of those. So by going to the root of all of those, in effect, you are making praise to all of those beings, but you are moreover emphasizing the importance of compassion. And so this is a really kind of a unique feature of this text. It's not that many texts that sort of praise these qualities and what have you. They generally are praising beings, Buddhas, Manjushri for texts that deal with wisdom, for example. You know, all of these beings who have these amazing qualities are certainly, again, objects of worship, objects of homage. Now, at the very end, it talked about calling this great compassion the Bhagavati. Bhagavati or Bhagawan, these are both that's the female and male versions of this word Bhagawan, which essentially means the blessed one, the one who has, again, attained this very holy state of enlightenment. So the when we talk about it, though, in terms of what it signifies, because those of you who've studied the Heart Sutra, for example, know that there, Bhagavati is used in the title of the Heart Sutra in Sanskrit. That's because we generally are talking about, when we talk about what is a Buddha, what is the essence of a Buddha? It is that perfect mind of a Buddha, but especially the perfected wisdom of a Buddha. So when we talk about the perfection of wisdom or the culmination of this development of one's mind into Buddhahood, this is what we mean by a Bhagawan or a Bhagavati. And of course, wisdom is seen as the female aspect, and so we call that Bhagavati, whereas normally we would think of compassion or the method as the male side, but nonetheless, we're giving the name of Bhagavati to compassion, because great compassion is the essence of what ripens into that perfection of wisdom, that mind that has developed a complete understanding of emptiness, and of course, by virtue of that, also understands all phenomena, has attained the omniscient state of a Buddha. So essentially, that profound wisdom, that perfection of wisdom is the result, and we're sort of calling the cause by the name of the result, saying that if this is the goal is to achieve Bhagavati, the full perfection of wisdom in Buddhahood, well, then we're going to call great compassion that. We're going to give it the same name, because essentially the cause isn't identical to the result, but it is what leads to the result. So this is kind of setting the stage for how we're going to be looking at compassion in the beginning of this text and seeing that it is the root of everything that comes forward. Now, again, when we get into this, it's a bit like a chicken and the egg sort of thing. You know, what comes from what? I mean, because people develop compassion, obviously, through the influence of the Buddhas, of those holy beings who, you know, instill that desire to generate compassion and so on. So it is a little circular, just like the chicken and the egg. Can you find any beginning point? But remember, Buddhism doesn't teach a beginning point. It's always been in this sort of cycle of things arising from something else, giving rise to something else, and so on, and never finding any sort of initial point. But nonetheless, Chandrakirti is going to pick this as sort of the beginning point and emphasize its importance. And of course, we're going to see three types of compassion that elaborate on how we go about generating that great compassion to the strongest degree. So then we have essentially the verses we just read. So I'm not going to go through those again. Instead, I'm going to jump forward into the commentary on that part, the first two verses. So this discussion has two parts: compassion as the main cause of a bodhisattva, and compassion as the root of the other two causes of a bodhisattva. Remember, there are three causes of a bodhisattva. We saw this last week briefly when we put up this chart on the Mahayana path. And to the left here are great compassion, which again is the main thing we're paying homage to here, non-dual awareness, and then bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. These three are said to be the causes of a bodhisattva. We'll get to them a little bit later tonight, hopefully. But they are among them. Great compassion is said to be the root. So this is the idea behind that, is that we're going to be looking at the compassion as being the root of the other two causes, and of course it being the root cause of a bodhisattva, and the bodhisattva being a cause of a Buddha, and the Buddha being cause of the other practitioners. So let's take a look at, let me pull up it's this one here. This is handout number 2 that I've prepared for this class. There are 4 handouts in total, and again, they won't identically, you know, mirror the 4 sessions, but we went through the entire first handout in the first class last week. So what we're looking at in terms of this beginning part is this whole little upward diagram that's there in front of you. So if we go down to the bottom of this, we see the three practices, the main causes of a bodhisattva, which are the mind of great compassion, which as we'll see is the root of the other two, non-dual awareness, which I'll explain later, and then the altruistic mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta. Those three practices ripen into that person actually becoming a bodhisattva. These are all done on the path prior to becoming a bodhisattva. When one becomes a bodhisattva, then one does ripen their minds into their own state of Buddhahood, and then in the state of Buddhahood becomes a source of teachings for hearers and solitary realizers. That's the main way that there is a sort of a progress from these moving upward. But there are going to be some, you know, arguments and things that we encounter as we go through the text that challenge, well, why do we say, you know, that Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas, you know, and aren't the bodhisattvas born from Buddhas in the way I was talking about, that, you know, Buddhas teach those bodhisattvas, what have you, you know. So we'll get into a little bit of the ins and outs of this, but this is the schema that Chandrakirti is using in the very first part of this. And he's going to start at the top and essentially say, hearers and solitary realizers arise from Buddhas, what are called kings of subduers. Buddhas arise from bodhisattvas, and bodhisattvas arise from those three causes. Therefore, at the root of all of them is great compassion. So what I'm debated on how to do this. We, on this handout, we also have an introduction to these different practitioners. Let's go ahead and look at the first two on the handout, and then I'll go to the text. I mentioned both of these last week because we talked about the three vehicles, the three practitioners. Essentially, we have those of the hearer lineage, Shravakas in the Sanskrit, the solitary realizers, which are Pratyeka Buddhas, and then the Bodhisattvas. Of course, they ripen into Buddhas, but we're going to see Buddhas coming up first before bodhisattvas in our little causal process that Chandrakirti's spelling out. But let's take a look at what these first two are, because once more, these are both what we often call Hinayana or fundamental vehicle or individual vehicle practitioners. They are those who have the predisposition to attain their own liberation, individual liberation from enlightenment. I'm sorry, from samsara. Got to keep my words straight tonight, or I'm going to say all sorts of weird things. They want to attain their own individual liberation from samsara. They want to attain the state of what we called again last week, foe destroyers or arhats. So the first one, the Shravakas, the hearers, the Tibetan for this is Nyanto or Todrop. They kind of have different meanings depending upon which term you use. The first one, Nyanto, hearers are called listener hearers. This is actually the literal translation of that. Since, having listened to the teachings, they practice them and cause others to hear about what they have achieved. So they listen to the teachings, they engage in the full practice of them, and on the basis of those teachings they received from that Buddha, they achieve the result of foe destroyer. But hearers are also called hearer proclaimers, todok, meaning that they do, however, actually proclaim the Mahayana to others, although unlike bodhisattvas, they do not practice it. So they do have this feature of hearing the Mahayana teachings, but they think, oh, those are not the teachings for me, but I'm happy to expound those, you know, proclaim them to other people, because other people may have a disposition for those, and so they engage in some teaching of those, but they don't practice them. They cultivate merit and wisdom, these two branches of the path that are even important for these lower results of the hearers and solitary realizers, their state of foe destroyer. You still do have to have some collection or accumulation of merit and an accumulation of wisdom. But they only do that over three lifetimes in order to achieve what we are considering a small enlightenment, or again, the state of foe destroyer for the hearer practitioner. Solitary realizers are a unique brand of sort of Hinayana practitioner. The Rangsangye is the Tibetan for these Pratyeka Buddhas. Essentially, I think there's even another term that's Rangyal, which means sort of a self-conqueror. The idea is that they have this disposition that's kind of interesting, because they want to be sort of individual practitioners on their own, the way that this word solitary realizer is used. So while there are some of them that do congregate to some degree and are with groups of people, and obviously they need to receive teachings often in groups of people, they tend to practice on their own, and they especially make these prayers for their last lifetime so that they're able to achieve their enlightenment or their, you know, individual liberation in a place where they are doing that completely on their own. let's look at what it says here. According to Maitreya's Ornament of Clear Realizations, solitary realizers make these three prayers. One, to not rely on the teachings of a master in their last rebirth. So they make these prayers to be reborn in a place where there isn't a Buddha, where they can attain their own, again, middling enlightenment, their own state of freedom from the afflictions and so on, without relying upon a teacher in that rebirth. Now, of course, they've received teachings in other rebirths that they are practicing, but in that last rebirth, they want this sort of independent quality. To be born, secondly, where there are no Buddhas or hearers present, and third, to be able to teach others with only bodily gestures. So they engage in these things, in these sort of miraculous shows, emanations that teach others and show them that they can achieve great attainments and what have you. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama sometimes talks about how, you know, they obviously must have a little bit of a, I don't know, maybe it's a pride, but not a deluded pride, but some sense of like, I want to do this on my own kind of thing. But yet they have a lot of compassion too, because the hearers as well might proclaim the Mahayana Dharma, but the solitary realizers want to be born into a world where there aren't any Buddhas or hearers present so that they can proclaim the Dharma in their own special way, only using bodily gestures, what have you, and, you know, helping others in that way. So His Holiness always points out how it might sound like there's sort of this, you know, thing on their own that's not doing anything to benefit others, but they actually do have that compassion that does want to benefit others. Again, not the great compassion we're talking about here, but they do have a strong compassion that wishes to actualize some method of teaching others. These bodily gestures, they say, I think one of them is like you show fire from the waist up and water from the waist down or something. I mean, I don't know what these inspire the practitioners who see them to think, oh, I want to attain these great states or whatever. Anyway, these solitary realizers cultivate merit and wisdom over 100 eons to achieve middling enlightenment. So they're quite a bit advanced beyond the three lifetimes of the hearers. They do engage in a lot more practice in order to achieve their result. So let's talk about those two first before we go forward. And that's because, again, this next outline is called The Way Hearers and Solitary Realizers Are Born from Kings of Subduers. Then we'll go on to The Way Buddhas Are Born from Bodhisattvas and look at the three main causes of Bodhisattvas. Again, this is my plan to get through all of this tonight, if not maybe even a little bit more of the next section. Hearers and middling realizers of suchness, Chandrakirti says, are born from the kings of subduers. So again, we saw that verse earlier. The kings of subduers are the Buddhas. So let's look at the section dealing with the hearers first. Hearers are so called because they listen to correct precepts from others, and after attaining the fruit of their meditation, the enlightenment of a hearer, or again, that self-liberation, individual liberation of a hearer, they cause others to hear about that fact. They say, I have done what was to be done. I will not know another birth, and so forth. So many such instances appear in the scriptures. You know, many of the Buddhist practitioners attain this state of a foe destroyer. They were these hearers who accomplished that result in that lifetime. And it says, although there are some hearers, such as those in the formless realm, to whom this etymology does not apply, there's no fault, because the features of an etymology do not have to apply to all instances for a term to be used as an actual name. We're talking here about an actual name versus a sort of imputed name. You know, for instance, the term lake-born is used for a lotus grown from dry soil. I mean, lake-born, lotuses normally grow from lakes, so that's the name that we would give them. I guess it might even be the Sanskrit or the Tibetan derivation of the word for lotus is lake-born. But it can be used for a lotus that's grown from dry soil, right? We'd still call it a lotus, even if it's not being, you know, grown out of water. So it's the same here. Those who are in the formless realm, again, being the state of existence where beings don't have a gross form, they don't have a body where they would be able to hear things, see things, touch things, what have you. Instead, they are in that formless realm, abiding in a mental state with a very, very, what's present is just some subtle wind energy. According to the highest teachings of the Buddha, that's the only form that's present there, is that kind of wind energy. So we can say they're not hearers when they're born in that realm. If they create the karma to be reborn in the formless realm, well, then they aren't hearers because you can't hear anything in that realm. Anyway, the idea is that all of the instances of that don't have to, you know, be exactly in line with the definition or the derivation of that word. The Sanskrit word for hear, Tsongkhapa says, Shravaka, can also mean hearing and proclaiming, in the sense that they hear from Buddhas about the superior fruit or the path proceeding to Buddhahood and proclaim it to those of the Mahayana lineage seeking that path. So this is what I mentioned earlier. There are a second, etymology of that and why they're called hearer proclaimers, because they will proclaim the Mahayana. So there's a quote then from the White Lotus of Excellent Doctrine Sutra. It says, and this is in reference to bodhisattvas who do something similar, who merely proclaim the path without practicing it. Let's hope we don't fall into that category at any point, that we proclaim the path, but we also are happily practicing it. But this little quote says, O protector, today we have become hearers. We proclaim the excellent enlightenment and set forth the terms of enlightenment. Thus, we are like these intractable, stubborn hearers. So this is kind of, a quote coming from those who are merely proclaiming the bodhisattva path, and they are bodhisattvas, but they aren't practicing it. So they're kind of like those hearers. They're proclaiming the Buddhahood, excellent enlightenment of the bodhisattva path, Buddhahood, and they set forth that path that leads to that. So they're kind of intractable, like intractable hearers in that way. Again, it's not such an important point, but nonetheless, I'll go through most of the commentary. There are a few places where I'll skip some paragraphs just because it might get a little too complicated to get into the full commentary. So now there's somebody named Jaya Ananda. The first part up there at the top. For those two reasons, these bodhisattvas are similar to hearers. But the actual meaning of hearing and proclaiming applies only to hearers. We wouldn't call those bodhisattvas hearers. They are bodhisattvas. They have bodhicitta in their continuum at this very deep degree. But nonetheless, they are behaving like hearers and only proclaiming the Mahayana Dharma and not practicing it. So as I was getting ready to say in this next paragraph is this person named Jaya Ananda. Jaya Ananda wrote a commentary on Chandrakirti's text, which Tsongkhapa takes issue with frequently. And, there are times where he puts Jaya Ananda down, and there are other times where he commends him and saying, it's excellent that he did this and he included that. We'll see both of those in this bit of commentary that we're looking at. So here, Tsongkhapa says that Jaya Ananda says that because the word excellent is absent in the third line of the quote from the White Lotus, the former enlightenment is the Mahayana and the latter the hearer enlightenment. So if we look at that verse, it would mean that where it says, we proclaim the excellent enlightenment, that would be talking about Buddhahood. But because excellent is missing in the third line, we're talking about them only setting forth the terms of the lower enlightenment, the small enlightenment of the hearers. So that's what Jaya Ananda is holding. However, the thought of Chandrakirti's commentary, he says, is that the first is the Mahayana enlightenment, and the second is the path proceeding to that Mahayana enlightenment. So anyway, that's just another little fine point that doesn't really have that much bearing on it, but it is important that we understand again that this is Tsongkhapa trying to really be clear about what Chandrakirti is saying, what these various verses are saying. So now an objection is raised, and this often happens in these texts too. Remember, one of the things I was hoping from this course, one of my objectives was to give you some exposure to this type of study where you look at these commentaries and kind of see the ways that various objectors come forward and then they're refuted, answers are given to them. In this case, we have an objector who says, bodhisattvas, if that's the case, or that particular etymology of hearer-proclaimer, bodhisattvas would absurdly have to be Hinayana hearers because they hear the path of Buddhahood from Buddhas and proclaim it to trainees. So in the same way that the hearers do that, that they proclaim the Dharma of the Mahayana, but they, they practice whatever. I mean, in the case of the hearers, they don't practice the Mahayana. But essentially, because of this side of them that they proclaim it to trainees, well then, those bodhisattvas are similar to hearers. We'd have to really call them hearers. Well, the answer is given. There's no such fault. Because the thought here is that hearers merely proclaim the Mahayana path. They themselves do not achieve even a similitude of it. So the delineation here was just to say, when we talk about hearers proclaiming the Mahayana Dharma, they proclaim it, but they don't practice it to any degree. Whereas bodhisattvas, they do proclaim it to others. So in that way, we could call them proclaimers of the Mahayana, but they're totally different than the hearers. Why? Because they are practicing the Mahayana Dharma, not merely proclaiming it. Now, again, we have that example of those bodhisattvas who are behaving like hearers, who have obviously developed bodhicitta, or they wouldn't be a bodhisattva, but nonetheless fall into that sort of behavior of not teaching or not practicing what they're proclaiming, you know, proclaiming the Mahayana to everyone, but not practicing it. So again, we should watch that we don't fall into that category, but nonetheless, we don't want to equate bodhisattvas and hearers simply on the basis that they proclaim the Mahayana. Because over here, you have beings who never practice that Mahayana while they are here, and over here, you have people who are intent upon practicing it generally, and who put a lot of energy into doing that. So now we go on to these middling realizers of suchness, as they were called in our verse. In Chandrakirti's root text, middling realizers of suchness, these solitary realizers, was translated into Tibetan as middling Buddhas. Remember, the term that we had was Rangsangye. Sangye, many of you know this term, Sangye, it means Buddha. Generally, that's how it's translated. But in this case, it means a realizer. And we're going to talk about that in this first paragraph. But, you know, this sort of Rangsang means, you know, middling, that in that sort of middle category of realization. So, again, this is a Tibetan term that they came up with. Oftentimes, the Tibetan terms are a little different than the Sanskrit in terms of the meanings of the individual words that go into them. So, continuing, Tsongkhapa says, in the commentary, Chandrakirti says that Tattva Buddha applies to all three persons, hearers, solitary realizers, and Buddha superiors, you know, those who are, have realized emptiness at that level. With regard to the meaning of this, some identify Tattva Buddha as realization of suchness and apply it to all three. As will be explained, this is a good interpretation because it is said Tattva means suchness. As when we talk about the tathagata or the tatata, this is the suchness, the emptiness that is realized, and Buddha means realization. So when the term Buddha is taken to mean realization of suchness, this applies to all three persons, hearers, solitary realizers, and bodhisattvas who become Buddhas eventually on the basis of that wisdom. Okay, so what's being said here is, it's kind of just trying to explain again the choice of words that Chandrakirti has and then how those were translated into Tibetan. In Tibetan, the solitary realizer, Pratyeka Buddha, is translated into a middling realizer of suchness or middling Buddha. But we're not talking about Buddha equivalent to the Buddha that is the final goal. Here, we're equating Buddha to a realizer, to the realization of something. And the middling realization, of course, we're going to talk a little bit more about that compared to a small realization or a great realization, is what this solitary realizer is in that category, kind of between those two. And we'll get into this in more detail. But the point that was being made here is that to apply this term, Tattva Buddha, or a sort of realizer of suchness, realizer of emptiness, to all three categories, here, solitary realizers, and bodhisattvas who become Buddhas, is correct. Why? Because all three of those realize the same suchness, the same emptiness. This is a unique tenet of the Prasangika Madhyamaka school, the middle way consequence school. This is what they discerned from the Buddha's teachings and the Prajnaparamita is that it is essential, whether you want to achieve your own liberation, as a hearer does, or a solitary realizer does, or whether you want to attain Buddhahood, as a bodhisattva does, you have to realize emptiness. I mentioned this last week briefly, but essentially the realization is the same. What is being realized, emptiness, suchness, thusness, it's sometimes called, selflessness. This object that is being realized is the same by all three of these practitioners. That's the only way to attain liberation and the only way to attain enlightenment. Without that wisdom realizing emptiness, it is impossible to attain those goals. So if you talk about somebody who is actually achieving the goal of a hearer path, becoming an arhat, a foe destroyer of that path, or achieving the goal of the solitary realizer, the middling realizer of Buddhas, or middling realizer of suchness that we're talking about here. If they achieve their result of arhat, foe destroyer, well, then they have to have realized emptiness. There's no way to achieve that goal without that same realization. Now, why that is so unique is because all these other tenet systems, if you study tenets, you'll know this, but all of them point to different realizations that need to happen. You know, especially those who are in the Mahayana lineages, those tenet systems. They essentially say to realize your own liberation, individual liberation, you only have to realize selflessness of persons. But to realize Buddhahood, well, then you have to have direct realization of emptiness, that is a more profound view of emptiness on the basis of selflessness of phenomena, things that are not persons, also having that error that we have, and then therefore being discerned correctly through the wisdom realizing emptiness. So again, this is just something that is being pointed out here, and I think I mentioned in last week's class, Tsongkhapa spends a good part of the beginning of this. There's like a little bit of Chandrakirti, but it's a whole lot of Tsongkhapa talking about how it is absolutely certain that hearers and solitary realizers realize suchness, realize emptiness, just like bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas have to do it to achieve enlightenment, but those other two practitioners have to realize it in order to attain their own liberation. Okay, so let's go back to the text and continue with the talking about these middling realizers of suchness, these solitary realizers. So it says there, then, in the next paragraph, though the term realizers of suchness also indicates solitary realizers, it was translated into Tibetan as Buddha. In general, the term Buddha should be rendered as Buddha, meaning the fully enlightened being that we normally talk about as Buddha. When we use the word Sangye, we generally mean that, a complete Buddha. But here, this is not appropriate. So we wouldn't say this is a middling Buddha and have the same sort of idea that it's a fully enlightened being. So it says, for it is also explained that Buddha is used to indicate an opening of lotus petals and an awakening from sleep. Therefore, Buddha is not the only translation. So if we look at this, it's kind of a weird little reference here to, you know, these different meanings of these words. The word I mentioned earlier, Sangye, is the two words they put together for Buddhahood, or meaning of Buddha. Gye can mean opening. Gye normally in the context of Buddha means fully developing, cultivating all the qualities. So it's kind of that opening to the vastness of these amazing qualities that a Buddha has. Awakening from sleep is another way that we could translate sang, the first syllable in sangye in the Tibetan. But sang in the context of sangye normally means to completely purify. And so again, anyway, there's different meanings that these words have in different contexts. So it's just kind of giving another excuse as to why we could render the word Buddha, Sangye, in this context, Rang Sangye. We could translate that slightly different than what we normally would translate Sangye. Here again, it's going to mean a realizer, someone who has realized emptiness or suchness. So that's what he goes on to say in the next paragraph. With respect to the meaning of middling, solitary realizers surpass hearers through their superior feature of practicing merit and wisdom for 100 eons. Remember, the hearers only did it for 3 lifetimes. However, since they do not have the 2 collections of merit and wisdom, nor the compassion viewing all sentient beings at all times, nor omniscience and so forth, they are certainly inferior to perfect Buddhas. You know, the bodhisattvas developed their merit and wisdom over the course of 3 great countless eons, much more than 100 eons. Thus, they are middling. But they are middling realizers of suchness, middling Buddhas, again, if we want to use that term, but with the understanding that we're not talking about the fully enlightened being in that context. We're talking about them being a realizer of suchness. So that's the idea behind that, is that they are middling in that context. Just to point out, again, for the bodhisattva, this chart shows where at the very top here where you are creating your 3 great countless eons of merit. The first is accumulated over the passive accumulation and passive preparation. The second is accumulated from when one enters the path of seeing, goes through the path of meditation to the end of the seventh ground. From the eighth through the tenth ground before one becomes a Buddha is the third great countless eon of merit and wisdom that are accumulated. So now, is it that much time that one has to generate all of that? It is equivalent to that amount of time. They say that actually you can accelerate that through various practices and various paths and actions and what have you. So it's not to say that you absolutely have to be around for three great countless eons, but nonetheless, the Bodhisattva path is a very long path as it's taught in the sutra teachings. Okay, so I mentioned I'm going to skip over some paragraphs in the commentary. This is one I'm going to skip over, but I'm going to give you just a really brief commentary on what that means. When we look at the whole idea of solitary realizers in some of the other tenet systems, they actually say that they have a deeper understanding of another form of selflessness that the hearers don't have. But our tradition, once more, says that all three practitioners realize the same thing. So that's the gist of that little argument. I don't want to go any further into it because I think it gets a little bit further afield. So I'm sorry, there is a question that came up. Let me go ahead in terms of... Let me answer these before we go forward, because otherwise I'm afraid I'll get a little bit too behind on some of the questions, and then we'll take a break again in a few minutes once we get to about halfway through the class. Is stream enter the same as a hearer? Stream enter is the term that's used often in the Hinayana tradition to refer to those who have had their initial direct realization of emptiness. So it would be a hearer who is a superior, an Arya. But it's not necessarily all Aryas, because you can attain some of the other results. There's stream enter, once returner, non-returner, and then the result of foe destroyer. That's way afield what we're talking about here, though. But stream enter is a term that's normally referring to those, again, based on certain conditions that they had, those who have entered the path of seeing. They've had their initial direct realization of emptiness on the Hinayana path, the hearer path. In reference to hearer proclaimers, why would one know the teaching and proclaim it but not practice it? Again, it all has to do with one's own predispositions. You know, why are some people born into the world wanting to, like, become firefighters and go into, you know, burning buildings to rescue people, and other people are so averse to that idea? It all has to do with kind of what one comes into this life with in terms of some level of compassion, courage, conviction to do something that maybe goes beyond what other people might do. Again, that's just an example, but the idea is that these beings who the Buddha taught these paths for, the hearers and the solitary realizers, don't have yet the inclination that is the Mahayana motivation. They don't yet have the idea of carrying the burden of liberating all beings from suffering, bringing them all to enlightenment through their own enlightenment. Instead, they want to achieve their own liberation because that's the burden that they can bear. And it's a noble cause. One less being suffering in samsara. You know, we can all, you know, be very happy when that person who has that inclination achieves their resultant state of being an arhat or a foe destroyer. And they're completely liberated from samsara. But again, they might proclaim that Mahayana Dharma to others because they're recognizing that not everybody is like them. And just like, I mean, when we proclaim the Dharma to others, we certainly put a Mahayana spin on everything, but we are often giving Hinayana teachings, essentially. If we look at the Lam Rim, most of you know the Lam Rim, the first two levels of the Lam Rim are teachings that come from the hearer, solitary realizer lineage in terms of how to attain a good rebirth and how to attain our own liberation. It's not till you get to the great scope that you add on things that are not taught in the Hinayana lineage, you know, for those who have that predisposition. But people who hear that, they might think, oh, well, there might be people who I come into contact with who would like those teachings and follow them and have an inclination towards them. Good for them. But that's just not for me, you know. So that's the idea behind it, is that there are different predispositions. And what does practice mean in this explanation? It would mean that they don't generate bodhicitta, that they don't then engage in the six perfections in terms of developing all of the practices of a bodhisattva on the basis of bodhicitta. That's what it really means to practice the Mahayana, is to do those two things of the sort of method side of the path that is motivated by bodhicitta, and then the deeper wisdom that is together with bodhicitta as well that allows one to attain the results of Buddhahood. So again, that's what we would mean by practice. And then the final question. Final question is an arhat, solitary realizer. Okay, so the term arhat, again, I just translated that a few seconds ago as a foe destroyer. That's the general translation of that. Arhat is the result of a Hinayana path. And so we have two Hinayana paths, the hearers and the solitary realizers. Both of those become arhats when they have completely removed all of the afflictions, all of the ignorance, everything built on that ignorance. That's their path. You know how I put up this little five Mahayana path thing? Let me put that up now. There's a similar one for the hearers and solitary realizers. It doesn't look like this because they don't go through all of the things that the Bodhisattva does, but it does look like it in terms of these five paths. They don't, of course, proceed with all of these. What they have is their sort of main preceding thought is the mind of renunciation. Renunciation being the mind that even bodhisattvas also do have to cultivate. It's sort of self-compassion. But for hearers and solitary realizers, they have the mind of renunciation, which is there in a spontaneous way. It causes them to enter their path of accumulation. They go then into the path of preparation when they have a clearer view of emptiness. Then when they directly realize emptiness, they go into their path of seeing, and then throughout the path of meditation, and as well as the path of seeing, they remove all of the afflictive obstructions. The afflictive obstructions are what keep you, yourself, bound in samsara. It's what keeps you from having nirvana, that state of peace that is there when you have removed all of those. So their path of no more learning is called arhatship or foe destroyer, whereas the path of no more learning for a bodhisattva is called Buddhahood. That's where you achieve the state of Buddhahood. So essentially, they have an identical path in terms of these five, but again, a lot of this other detail would be very, very different for those who are on the Hinayana path. But they go through a similar process, but when they get to their result, they attain a state of foe destroyer, or arhat, and you have, again, arhats that were solitary realizers, arhats that were hearers. They then check out a samsara, because, of course, they have a body that was created through the force of afflictions and karma, and they no longer have created any karma for rebirth and samsara because they are liberated. They sort of check out of this existence, leave that body behind, and abide in a sort of a mental body. And the story is that they are actually moved out of that state of solitary peace, that state of nirvana that they attain, by a Buddha who has some sort of karmic connection with them, who essentially taps them on a shoulder, in a sense, not that they have a shoulder at that point, but essentially says to them, you haven't done all the work there is to be done. You have to enter the Mahayana. So then they have to go back and begin the Mahayana path and accumulate all the merit that's involved in that, along with bodhicitta and everything. They don't have to remove the afflictive obscurations because they already did that work. What they have to remove is what are called the knowledge obscurations, which of course the bodhisattva is intent upon removing as well. Those are these subtle imprints that keep you from having an omniscient mind. And so anyway, we'll talk about them maybe a little bit later, but the idea is that this isn't the state of foe destroyer or arhat isn't a final result. That's why in this tradition we say there is one final vehicle. You may do the path of the hearer or a solitude realizer and attain your arhatship and check out of samsara thinking you've done the work and now you can go on vacation forever. But that isn't all the work. You have to come back into the Mahayana and you have to attain Buddhahood as well. This is why oftentimes Tibetan teachers will caution people that you should, as much as possible, if you have some inclination, that predisposition towards the Mahayana, what we might call Mahayana lineage, it's really important to nurture and care for that and not let it fall to the Hinayana lineage. Why? Because you're going to end up spending so much more time going through the Hinayana path and then eventually checking out and abiding in that state of solitary peace, and then you finally get pulled back into the Mahayana and complete that and become a Buddha. All of that time, you could have just been in the Mahayana path and achieved Buddhahood much, much quicker. So the idea is that if you have this inclination, it's best to cultivate and really nurture your bodhicitta so that it grows and develops and you enter the Mahayana path right from the beginning. But of course, you have to have that predisposition. as I said, at the time of the Buddha, there were many, oftentimes in the sutras, they're called monks, right? There were a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. These monks are often these arhats who've developed their mind on the hearer path to that degree. And they're there in the audience and they're hearing the teachings, but they're not really for them. You know, they've already realized what they think needed to be realized and they're going to check out of samsara, but they're going to have to come back around and enter into the Mahayana. So it's a completely valid path that the Buddha taught, just for someone of a different disposition. Okay. What is the relationship of arhat to bodhisattvas and Buddhahood? I think I've explained it to some degree then. So again, an arhat could enter into the Mahayana path, become a bodhisattva, and eventually become a Buddha. But essentially an arhat is a specific result, the result of either of the Hinayana paths. We usually don't call a bodhisattva an arhat, even when they have removed the afflictive obscurations, which happens when they get to the end of the seventh ground. But anyway, that maybe helps to give some of these explanations of these things before I go too far into the terminology. So let's just go back to the text really, really briefly, because I think there's just a little bit left in terms of the solitary realizers. Let me put that up on the screen here. Whoops, not that one, this one. Actually, there's maybe a little too much. Let's go ahead and take our short break. And when we come back, we'll go into these three paragraphs. Again, I think I will do a little commentary on all of these and just kind of wrap up the whole topic of solitary realizers before we go on to the next line, which essentially says, you know, that they're born from kings of subduers, and those kings of subduers are born from bodhisattvas. All right. So again, feel free to put some questions in the chat box. I probably won't answer any until we get to the end of the class. Let's take about a 10-minute break. And so at 8:15 after, I'll ring the bell again and we'll resume. All right. Have a nice break. Okay. Welcome back. Again, there are times, again, I'll skip over a bit of the commentary or summarize some things simply because, once more, this commentary is oftentimes referring to things that will be coming in future parts of the text and maybe aren't as, you know, relevant to what we're looking at in terms of the topic of compassion and how we work with that. And I'm really anxious to get to the three types of compassion, which again is the real heart of this and where we really look at that idea of uniting wisdom and compassion. So what we've looked at so far, again, is this idea of this first line of hearers and middling realizers of suchness, examining both of those, and that they're born from Buddhas. We're going to get into that now. But let's go ahead and just finish off this second of these practitioners, the solitary realizers. So again, I'm going to read this through, but just make a very brief comment at the end of each of these paragraphs. I'm actually going to use an alternate version of the middle paragraph there, but Tsongkhapa then says, in his commentary, remember Chandrakirti wrote an auto-commentary, a self-commentary on his verses. He says that a solitary realizer's wisdom surpasses in its increase that of a hearer. This increase should be taken to mean proceeding higher and higher on the path. Solitary realizers are intent on cultivating merit and wisdom over 100 eons, again, compared to the three lifetimes of the hearers. Thus, unlike the hearers, they are able to continue cultivating the path for a long time. So again, we can say their wisdom surpasses that of the hearers on the basis of that. So let me go ahead and pull up on screen the slides I'd prepared. Again, there are not many for tonight. This is just the, get that slideshow to come up now from the current slide. Okay, good. This is the translation of this passage that comes from Thupten Jinpa, again, the new book that was published by Wisdom, entire text translated, Chandrakirti and then Tsongkhapa's commentary. Although the term collection may apply to merit and wisdom in general, the primary referent of collection here is as stated in the following, in the Clear Words commentary. They uphold great awakening, enlightenment, Buddhahood, by cultivating the perfect truth, and thus the collection is constituted by great compassion and so forth. So this is this whole idea of accumulation or collection, because we have talked about how, you know, the solitary realizers have a collection of merit and wisdom over 100 eons, and the hearers over three lifetimes. But as I mentioned, the bodhisattvas have it over three great countless eons, and that's generally what we mean by a fully qualified collection or accumulation. So that's what Tsongkhapa is saying here. Here, collection applies to those factors that uphold the fruit, unsurpassed awakening, Buddhahood, through methods that accomplish it without distortion. Hence, the term refers to merit and wisdom that embody this meaning. Those not encompassed by this meaning are only ordinary collections. This connotation of the term comes from the etymology of the word sambara, which is the Sanskrit word for collection. So the idea here is just that Tsongkhapa is essentially saying we can call those collection of 100 eons of merit and wisdom, but they're not really fully qualified collections because they don't become that until you unite them with bodhicitta and you become a bodhisattva and you accumulate with the goal of Buddhahood. So again, that's because in the Mahayana presentation, that's what we talk about as being a collection. So again, very brief comments, but nonetheless, I thought I would just talk about that briefly. The final paragraph that has to do with solitary realizers. By the way, it does give an etymology of sambara in that last little bracketed bit that Jeffrey Hopkins added in. I don't need to talk about that, I don't think. Because solitary realizers progress in merit and wisdom greatly exceeds that of hearers, they are able to generate the wisdom of a foe destroyer, Arhan or Arhat, during their final lifetime in the desire realm without depending on another master's teaching. Remember, that was one of their key prayers that they made. Because they become enlightened, that is to say, attain or are in the process of attaining the state of a foe destroyer, for their own sakes alone, they are called self-enlightened and also self-arisen. Again, because although they do have some compassion, wanting to teach to others and so on, like we saw earlier, they don't attain full enlightenment. It's really still for their own sakes alone that they attain the goal of foe destroyer or arhat. So now we go on to talk about the kings of subduers. Remember, we're saying that both of those practitioners are born from the kings of subduers. That's their main cause. So with respect to the phrase kings of subduers, the term subduer, this in the Sanskrit, this is Muni, like in Shakyamuni Buddha. And that term subduer or Muni is indeed used also for hearer and solitary realizer foe destroyers. Why? Because they have subdued the foe of faults. But since they are not kings of subduers, or to be more gender neutral, rulers of subduers, only Buddhas are so called. This is because Buddhas have attained an excellent lordship of doctrine, superior to hearers, solitary realizers, or even bodhisattvas, and also because the word of Buddha rules these three in the sphere of doctrine. In other words, the Buddha's dharma always sort of trumps the dharma of any other practitioner on a Buddhist path, because Buddha is the final culmination. It's the end result of all the Buddhist practice. As I explained earlier, even those that complete the Hinayana eventually enter the Mahayana, the final goal, the final vehicle being that which leads to Buddhahood. So they are the rulers, the rulers of subduers. Their dharma rules. They are have lordship over all the other practitioners. Then it says that hearers and solitary realizers are born from kings of subduers means that they are issued forth by them. So the question is raised, well, how do subduer kings give birth to hearers and solitary realizers? What is it that they do that helps them to come forward, to enter the Hinayana path with that uncontrived renunciation and practice the path that leads to foe destroyer? So the answer is, when Buddhas come to the world, they teach dependent arising without error. Now, what is meant by dependent arising in this context in particular is the 12 links of dependent arising, which is a wonderful teaching that we study generally in the middle scope of the Lam Rim that spells out the path by which we continue to take rebirth in samsara and how that can be upended by removing the root link, the first link of ignorance. So it says then, those bearing the lineage of hearers and solitary realizers listen to the modes of dependent arising, think about what they have heard, and meditate on the meaning of what they have thought. Through these stages, the aims of hearers and solitary realizers are fulfilled in accordance with the effect to which they aspire. And in this way, subduer kings give birth to hearers and solitary realizers. So essentially that paragraph is saying that they listen to the teachings on dependent arising, they think about them, reflect on them. Remember, that's the second type of wisdom after the wisdom of hearing. Third, they meditate on them. They develop the wisdom of meditation. So developing hearing, thinking, and meditating on dependent arising, they eventually attain freedom from samsara. Now, those of you who aren't familiar with the 12 links, I'm just going to show this very briefly because we're going to see it a little bit later when we have the first type of the three types of compassion. These are the 12 links of dependent arising, and I've given them a color coding. Hopefully I've been sensitive to those who are colorblind. I got a lesson in this from a student who is colorblind, and he encouraged me to use particular colors that they can discern the difference between. The ones that are orange, the first, the eighth, and the ninth are all afflictions. The ones that are black, number 2 and 10, are actions, karma. The rest of them are all the sort of resultant things that arise on the basis of our karma and afflictions. But these 12 links spell out, as I said, the beginning link of ignorance, the process by which we create an action that gets imprinted on our consciousness through the force of our existence in a life, through the craving and grasping that arises at the end of that. We then give birth to a new existence when that karma ripens, and we have the ensuing results. Again, I can't go into all the details of this. It's way beyond the scope of this course. But those teachings that the Buddha gave on the 12 links of dependent arising, which are common in the Pali Canon as well as in the Sanskrit teachings, the Mahayana teachings, are a way of examining the process by which we keep creating the cycle of existence. Every time we have, through the force of our ignorance, a thought, some words, or a physical action that is motivated by those, we create a seed, be it good or bad, for continued existence. And by understanding this, you can learn the reverse process of this, how to undo it, how to actually remove the root of ignorance, and thereby the whole thing completely falls apart and you attain liberation. So out of compassion, because we're going to keep coming back to compassion, the Buddha teaches dependent arising to hearers and solitary realizers, teaches them how to recognize the pattern that they are caught up in that keeps creating their samsara, whereby they generate the motivation to be free of that, to destroy the foe of the afflictions and everything built on the afflictions so that they can be liberated. So this is, again, speaking to how those hearers and solitary realizers arise from Buddhas. So now there's an objection, and what I think I'm going to do with this is sort of summarize this. Essentially what this has to do with is the fact that, you know, when we say that this is the cause, okay, so you have this Buddha that's the cause of these two practitioners. Well, the fact is one of them, they make prayers to be reborn in an existence without Buddhas. So how can you say that the Buddhas are the cause of their enlightenment or their attainment of foe destroyer, you know, that middling enlightenment, when the Buddhas aren't there? Well, and the answer to it essentially is saying, well, not everything has to be a cause in that lifetime. Because when we talk about karma, we talk about three different ways that karma can be definite. It can ripen in this lifetime, and there are those rare karmas that we actually do see ripening in this lifetime. I wouldn't say it's the bulk of what we create. Most of what we create ripens in the next lifetime, which is the second type of karma, or a lifetime beyond that. Third, you know, second out, third out, fourth out, whatever. So most karmas will probably ripen over some, you know, other lifetimes. Some of them in our next lifetime, and very few of them actually in this lifetime. They actually say that a lot of our karma can be accelerated in terms of ripening in this life based on creating more power behind it. For example, actions done towards our gurus are said to be really powerful in getting karma to ripen in this life so that we can experience the benefits of being in the presence of those gurus and achieve greater progress on the path to enlightenment through actions we do in relation to them. That's why so many of our actions in Tibetan Buddhism are focused on, you know, serving the guru, doing what we can to benefit the gurus, because if we do that, then we create that sort of karma that can ripen in this lifetime. But essentially going back to that argument, it doesn't hold water, because it's not saying that in that lifetime a Buddha has to be present acting as the main cause for that solitary realizer to attain their state of foe destroyer, because they already have the effects of that Buddha from prior lifetimes. You know, you don't have to, you know, posit it's in that lifetime, because we have karma that ripens outside of this lifetime. As I said, most of it actually does. Then there's a few verses that come in that talk about, you know, these solitary realizers and how they are realizing this in that way. I'm going to skip over those as well. And then this bottom part too. I think this gets into a little bit more of a complicated thing around what Jayananda is saying, and essentially saying that there's a lot of debates about, you know, solitary realizers and what have you. But I think it's a little beyond the scope of what we want to be working with in this course. So I hope it's okay with you. I'm going to skip over those, and that's just out of wanting to make sure I put a good amount of attention into the parts of the text that are more salient, perhaps, for our practice of compassion in our lives. So we get to the next part. This is the second of these three outlines in here, the way Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. So we had the first two lines. Again, hearers and middling realizers of suchness are born from Buddhas. Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. So this is essentially answering that question that somebody could put forward and saying, okay, hearers and solitary realizers are born from Buddhas, subduer kings. Well, what are they born from? You know, where do they come from? This is like a kid asking, you know, well, mommy, you know, where does that come from? And oh, but then where does that come from? As soon as you give the answer to something, there's always something else that precedes it. And of course, in Buddhism, this is one of the main principles of causality. Things always arising from something that preceded them. So the perfect Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. So right off the bat, we get an objection. And why is this objection here? Because oftentimes we do talk about bodhisattvas as being conqueror's children. Conqueror is another epithet for the Buddha. And we have all these words, the Sukhavati, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Anyway, there's all these different terms that are used for Buddhas that are ways of talking about the various qualities of the Buddhas. In fact, if you read the Sanskrit of that little praise we do at the beginning of the class, you get all of the epithets for a Buddha right there. And so we can call them the Bhagavan and the Tathagata and all these various things. Sugata, that's what I was trying to think of earlier. All of these phrases that refer to Buddhas. Well, one of the ways we talk about bodhisattvas is that they are the children of those Buddhas or conquerors, those who have conquered the foe, completely conquered all of the delusions, all of the obstructions in the mind. They are the children of those conquerors. So now you're telling me that the Buddhas are born from their children. How does that work? You know, how does somebody born from their children? And of course, this is just a play on all this because, of course, it depends on how you look at it. As I said earlier, we have to say that bodhisattvas are also born from Buddhas in a sense. Why? Because they don't generate great compassion, bodhicitta, all the practices of the path, without relying upon a Buddha. It would be impossible for them to do that. But they aren't born from the Buddhas in this context, because we're going to say that Buddhas are born from them. And we're going to explain two ways in which that happens. So let's go to the Lama Tsongkhapa's text, based very heavily on Chandrakirti's commentary here. So it says the objections raised, are bodhisattvas not called conqueror children because they are born from Buddhist teaching? Since bodhisattvas are our conqueror children, how can Buddhas be born from bodhisattvas? For example, the father of a child cannot be that child's child, right? Because they predated that child. They gave birth to that child, you know, the father through the mother giving the actual birth and what have you. You know, that's the father's child. How can that child give birth to the father? So the answer is, it is true that bodhisattvas are the children of certain conquerors, right? Those Buddhas who have that influence on them and guide them in their path. However, there are two reasons why bodhisattvas cause Buddhas. Bodhisattvas are causes of Buddhas from the viewpoint of state. This is the first one, because the state of a Tathagata Buddha is the fruit of that of a bodhisattva. And that's because every one of us, when we enter the Mahayana path, we eventually become that Buddha that is the culmination of the practices of a bodhisattva. So Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas in that they are the end result of a particular bodhisattva's continuum, mental continuum, that has fully ripened into that state. So it says, this indicates that bodhisattvas cause Buddhas through being the substantial cause, which is of the same continuum, mental continuum, as that Buddha. The state of Buddhahood is only attained through one's formerly having developed the state of a bodhisattva on the path of learning. So when we go back to the chart, this means that, again, you have a being who develops these three, enters into the Mahayana through uncontrived bodhicitta, develops their mind along these five paths, well, the four paths of learning, and then eventually becomes a Buddha on the path of no more learning. Their mind, as it's developing through this, is the substantial cause for the mind of a Buddha. Substantial cause is always the sort of essential thing from which something arises. When we talk about the substantial cause of a pot, a clay pot, it would be the clay that that pot is formed out of. But you have a lot of cooperative conditions that help that pot to come into existence, right? It doesn't just grow out of the clay on its own. It requires many other factors to be involved. But the main stuff from which that pot comes forth is the clay that was molded into that pot. In the same way, the main stuff that a Buddha's mind comes out of is the mind of a bodhisattva. And of course, our minds right now that are in the continuum that will eventually be our future Buddhahood, our future state of enlightenment. So that's the main way that we talk about Buddhas being born from bodhisattvas, because bodhisattvas develop their minds to become Buddhas. Makes sense, right? I mean, a lot of this is a bit overblown, perhaps, for what we're trying to, you know, get out of it. But these are important points to make sure that we get. So now there's a second way, as it said. Bodhisattvas also cause Buddhas through causing them to bear the truth in the sense that, as it says in Sutra, the Venerable Manjushri, as a bodhisattva, caused our own teacher, Shakyamuni, and other Buddhas to bear the altruistic mind of enlightenment at the very beginning. You know, like kind of encourage them on the way. So Manjushri was a bodhisattva, and there are oftentimes cases of other bodhisattvas who kind of encourage, they're like the cheering team for the young bodhisattvas to keep generating bodhicitta, to keep developing their minds in that direction. So they act as a cooperative condition, kind of aiding that bodhisattva in moving towards Buddhahood. So bodhisattvas help achieve the Buddhahood of other beings who are bodhisattvas by egging them on, helping them to, you know, move in that direction. So that says then, Tsongkhapa says, this establishes that Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas, secondly, from the viewpoint that a bodhisattva who is of a different continuum from the Buddhahood, which another bodhisattva will attain, acts as a cooperative cause of that Buddha. In other words, they instill that bodhisattva to, you know, kind of perfectly uphold their bodhicitta and keep moving forward. So this is essentially what we mean by this idea of there's two reasons or two things that we can look at logically that show why Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. The same continuum, this is a substantial cause, becomes a Buddha. That was the continuum of the mind of a bodhisattva. And other bodhisattvas help that bodhisattva to move their mind in that direction. So in that way, they act as a cooperative condition to help them to uphold the Mahayana, to keep strengthening their bodhicitta, to meditate further on great compassion and so on, to practice the perfections, what have you. So they kind of, again, we can see bodhisattvas helping in the process from the sidelines, as well as being the being who develops their mind into Buddhahood. And that's the idea once more behind why we can say this, even though we call them conqueror's children, even though we say that they are the offspring, in a sense, of Buddhas. And that's what this objection gets into, kind of says, well, you know, you've agreed that they are conqueror's children, so we still have a problem, essentially, is what this first paragraph is saying. So Chandrakirti states the position of an objector who says that since bodhisattvas are conqueror's children, it is correct for them to be born from conquerors. But the opposite isn't feasible. In answer, he says it is true that bodhisattvas are conqueror children, thereby indicating that he accepts this, though it is necessary to give the reason why, despite this assertion, there is no contradiction in saying that Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. Chandrakirti, without giving any such reason, goes on to establish that Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. Thus, his procedure is wrong because a doubt has already arisen with respect to the topic and has not been eliminated. So essentially this person is saying, but you've agreed that they're conqueror's children, and you haven't really given us a sufficient evidence as to why it's logical to say that, nonetheless, Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. So the answer from Tsongkhapa is, this fault doesn't exist. with respect to the first reason why the root text says that Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas, again, that substantial cause one, Chandrakirti explains the attainment of the fruit of Buddhahood through a bodhisattva's practice on the path of learning, you know, the path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, all those that are the path of learning, they eventually become a Buddha. So he says then, it is thereby known that a bodhisattva is not the child of the Buddha that he himself becomes, or she herself, whoever themselves become. Hence, when Chandrakirti says that it is true, meaning bodhisattvas are indeed born from Buddhas, they are children of the conquerors, how could he be referring to a bodhisattva's birth from the Buddha he becomes? Again, it's not logical. Just as we said, you know, a father can't be born from the child that they give birth to, you know, that they are part of the process of bringing into this world. They cannot possibly be born from that child. Then it says, furthermore, one newly born as a bodhisattva from the speech of our teacher is a child of this Buddha, but this Buddha is not born from that bodhisattva. Indeed, if one has intelligence, why would one not realize from the answer given in the commentary that the objector has not distinguished these two modes? Still, many senseless explanations have appeared with respect to this. So this is, you know, Tsongkhapa sometimes being a little hard on people. Calling somebody senseless is maybe not so bad. It gets worse in other parts of the text. But nonetheless, you know, when people come forward and they're being belligerent around, well, why do you call them conqueror's children? Aren't they born from the Buddhas? Aren't bodhisattvas born from Buddhas? Well, in that context, yes. But in this context, we're not talking about that. We're talking about those two points of view. Through reasoning, we can establish that it is the continuum of that bodhisattva that becomes the Buddha, and through the influence of other bodhisattvas, they are encouraged to keep going on the path, deepen their bodhicitta, and achieve enlightenment. Okay. So let's go then to the why Buddhas praise bodhisattvas. Buddhas praise bodhisattvas because bodhisattvas are the principal causes of Buddhas. There are four reasons for the praise. The first is that this excellent cause of Buddhahood is very profound and precious. In other words, we want to make people realize that that's the main cause of Buddhas. They come from bodhisattvas. Where do Buddhas come from? They come from those bodhisattvas. That's the source of them. The second is that through expressing worship to the cause, bodhisattvas, praise of the fruit, Buddhas, is intended implicitly. Just like when I mentioned earlier, when Chandrakirti praises compassion, he is also praising all of those beings that arise from that compassion. In a similar way, if we praise bodhisattvas, we are by default praising the fruit of those bodhisattvas, which is Buddhahood. The third reason is that one should value and sustain the state of a novice bodhisattva, an entry-level bodhisattva, for that is the shoot of the tree of Buddhahood that nourishes all beings. And the example that's used here is just as one who has seen the shoot, then finally the trunk and so forth of a medicinal tree bearing countless wished-for fruits would cherish and sustain the leaves of the tree when they are young and soft, very vulnerable. So one should value and sustain the state of a novice bodhisattva with great effort. So that idea of praising bodhisattvas is because when they are kind of brand new, they are to be tended to very carefully, just like this medicinal tree. And the fourth reason is that when bodhisattvas are praised in the presence of those who are established in the three vehicles, even those who are already on the hearer or solitary realizer path, such persons thereby definitely enter into the Mahayana. So the praise of bodhisattvas, again, has four ways that it sort of has an influence in a positive way on what is going on in the world, you know, and how we are able to then accumulate greater merit and awareness, what have you. So this is what Jetsun Choki Gyaltsen says on that, those four things. So he's essentially saying the meaning of this passage, the passage that's coming up next in our root text or our Tsongkhapa's illumination, is that there are four purposes for Buddhas praising bodhisattvas through that passage, again, that we're going to see in a moment. I'll just skip over that. Buddhas praised bodhisattvas, one, so that people will realize that bodhisattvas are the main causes of Buddhas. Secondly, because by expressing worship to the main cause of Buddhas, bodhisattvas, worship of the effect, Buddhas, becomes expressed. Again, these we saw earlier. I'm just giving you some different words based on Guy Newland's translation of Jitsunpa's commentary. Third, in order to make known that just as those who seek the trunk of a medicinal tree should value the shoot of that tree, those who respect and seek perfect Buddhahood should value and respect the shoot of a conqueror, a beginning bodhisattva. And then finally, fourth, in order to cause sentient beings who had come into his circle at the time, the Buddha circle, and who were set in the paths of the three vehicles, definitely to join just the Mahayana. So you can imagine, again, these gatherings of the Buddha giving discourses, and there are bodhisattvas. There were these eight bodhisattvas that were particularly renowned that include Avalokiteshvara and Manjushri, Maitreya, and so on. These bodhisattvas, the Buddha was often praising them in the presence of these other practitioners. Why? Because by praising the bodhisattvas, those who hear that praise are inclined to enter into the Mahayana. So again, just showing once more the compassionate ways that the Buddha is working with praising bodhisattvas, trying to encourage those to seek the greatest goal, to move towards complete enlightenment so they can join the ranks of the Buddhas and benefit others. So this is that little phrase from Pile of Jewels Sutra that is Jetsunpa was elaborating on the slides I just showed you. He says, Kashyapa, it is like this. For example, people bow down to a new moon and not to the full moon. You know, the new moon is where the moon is just beginning its process of waxing into the full moon. In the same way, Kashyapa, those who have great faith in me should bow down not to Tathagatas, but to bodhisattvas. Why? Tathagatas arise from bodhisattvas. All hearers and solitary realizers arise from Tathagatas. This establishes through scripture that Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. These two former reasons, the substantial cause and the cooperative conditions, those establish it through reasoning, because we can reason through and understand that both of those things are a way that Buddhas are born from bodhisattvas. But those are that's the scriptural source that sort of solidifies it. So this is the summary then. We've gone through and we looked at all three of those, the hearers, solitary realizers, the Buddhas, that they are born from the kings of subduers. So it says thus, here, Chandrakirti does not directly honor hearers, solitary realizers, Buddhas, or even bodhisattvas, who are renowned as objects of worship in other books. This is because he honors the causes that are their roots. He's already begun this process of looking at where things come from. So the first two lines of the root text indicate that these four, hearers and solitary realizers, Buddhas and bodhisattvas, are in an effect and cause relationship, respectively. This is for the sake of identifying the cause that is their ultimate root, compassion. Though bodhisattvas are born from the teaching of Buddhas, as we did see, that's why they're called conqueror's children, Chandrakirti does not need to explain this as he did for hearers and solitary realizers when he said that they are born from subduer kings. He taught that hearers and solitary realizers are born from subduer kings in order to show that their root ultimately derives from compassion. In the following stanzas, he indicates separately that the root of bodhisattvas derives from compassion. So that's again what we have in this chart. The second one, the handout, it shows again that what Chandrakirti is doing here, again, he could include bodhisattvas in that top line, but he's trying to emphasize that even these practitioners of the Hinayana, they come from compassion. Why? Because they arise from Buddhas, teaching them dependent arising. Where do the Buddhas come from? They come from the bodhisattvas, who are in their continuum that develop into that state, but also those that aid on the path, keeping those bodhisattvas, you know, tried and true on the Mahayana. Where the bodhisattvas come from, that's where we're going to next, looking at the three practices and causes of a bodhisattva. So you might take a look at the rest of this front page of the chart on your own. Again, this shows that kings of subduers, what they are, bodhisattvas, kind of how bodhisattvas give rise to Buddhas. The second side of this gets into what we're going to look at now, the three main causes of a bodhisattva. So let's go through this briefly, and then I'll go into the text again. The first cause that's identified is the mind of great compassion, which, as we're going to see, is the root of the other ones. This is the compassion, once more, that wishes all sentient beings to be free from suffering and the causes of suffering, and that aspires to protect or remove them from those. Again, that's what makes it great compassion, not just that wish, oh, may they not suffer, but I will do that. I will remove their suffering. Non-dual awareness. This is a wisdom consciousness that is free from the two extremes of things, which we might call existence or permanence, and non-things, non-existence or annihilation. We're going to talk more about this when we talk about emptiness, but this is already a view of emptiness that is between the two extremes, not negating the existence of things utterly, nor is it holding to things to exist in this fictitious way that we already have been clinging to since beginningless time. And we'll talk about that more a little bit later. But this is a wisdom component that we want to bring in as a cause for a bodhisattva. Not all bodhisattvas have this non-dual awareness, but we're going to see, again, those that are very sharp faculty that really want to be sure that they can accomplish the path to enlightenment will develop some awareness of emptiness before they enter the path. On the basis of those two, the third one, bodhicitta, the altruistic mind of enlightenment, the desire for perfect enlightenment, which we often call the object of attainment, for the welfare of all sentient beings, which is the object of intent. The intent is to benefit all beings, but we have to attain enlightenment in order to accomplish that. So, in the context of the homage to compassion, these three are the main causes for producing a novice bodhisattva, a bodhisattva who has just entered the Mahayana path of accumulation. So once more, that's why it shows those on this chart as all preceding. This is before one becomes a bodhisattva. You're an ordinary being up to this point. And then you become an ordinary bodhisattva. You enter into the Mahayana with that circle two there, which is uncontrived bodhicitta, uncontrived mind of enlightenment. That's your, when you get to be a card-carrying bodhisattva, you know, so you have that bodhicitta that makes your mind very firm. But it's not completely firm yet because it can still be swayed. So let's begin a little bit of this. I'm just going to do this for a few minutes and then we'll take any other questions that might be there for tonight. So, just as we saw earlier, the question then is asked, well, where do those come from? If hearers and sellers who realizers are born from subduer kings, and if subduer kings are born from bodhisattvas, well, what causes bodhisattvas? Chandrakirti's text says, the mind of compassion, non-dual understanding, and the altruistic mind of enlightenment are the causes of children of conquerors, bodhisattvas. The main causes of bodhisattvas, Tsongkhapa says, are three. A compassionate mind, which will be explained in the following stanzas, you know, because this is what the whole homage is about. A wisdom realizing the meaning of freedom from the two extremes with regard to things, non-things, and so forth. And bodhicitta, an altruistic mind of enlightenment. So, Chandrakirti says in his commentary that the altruistic mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, is as shown in the quoted sutra. The Omnipresent Doctrine Sutra says, one realizes the suchness of phenomena and generates the thought, I will cause sentient beings to understand this nature of phenomena. This shows that, again, for that bodhisattva, who is a bit sharper in faculties, they have this non-dual understanding that precedes bodhicitta. Remember, that was the second of the three causes. The third one is bodhicitta. Bodhicitta comes about when one says, there's this error that beings are making, this non-recognition of the suchness, the emptiness of things. And therefore, I'm going to cause these beings to understand that so they can be free from their suffering. This mind, which is generated, is called an altruistic mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta. Now, this does not indicate all the characteristics of an altruistic mind generation or bodhicitta. Why? Because it takes cognizance of only one part, its objects of intent. Remember, we just had that on the screen, right? The objects of intent is the welfare of all sentient beings. This bodhisattva is thinking, I'm going to get all these beings to realize suchness. Because if they realize suchness, they'll be free from their suffering and they'll be able to achieve Buddhahood, their full enlightenment. But what's only being talked about in that, right? Somebody's saying, oh, I'm going to cause all these beings to understand emptiness. Well, the definition in Chandrakirti's commentary, Tsongkhapa says, is also partial. He says one definitely generates an altruistic mind thinking, I will relieve all these worldly beings from suffering and will definitely join them to Buddhahood. That's still working only with the object of intent. So the commentary does not mention taking cognizance of the object of attainment, one's own enlightenment, which, of course, one has to do in order to achieve the object of intent. So let's stop there and we'll finish, you know, come back to that next week. But the idea here is bodhicitta has two aspirations, two desires. One is this object of intent. I want to benefit all beings. And as Chandrakirti and Tsongkhapa are already pointing out, in order to get to that place where you think you're that dedicated that you are going to help all beings to be free from suffering and attain enlightenment, you have to have some confidence that there's a means to do that and to want them to accomplish that. In this case, it's, of course, all revolving around lacking the wisdom of emptiness. If sentient beings had the wisdom of emptiness, they wouldn't be suffering. So if the bodhisattva, first they generate great compassion, being moved by the suffering of the world, then they investigate emptiness and come to a good understanding of emptiness, and they see that if beings understood emptiness, they would be free from suffering, well, then they can dedicate themselves to enlightenment. This is, again, what those that are called the sharp faculty bodhisattvas, which maybe we all are, because none of us that I'm, well, again, I can't speak for all of you. I can speak for me. I don't have uncontrived bodhicitta. I'm not a bodhisattva, you know, card-carrying bodhisattva. This is my path right now, is to investigate all these teachings to generate the confidence that I can attain enlightenment, moreover, that all beings can attain enlightenment through understanding the wisdom of emptiness. Then I can have bodhicitta that is informed already once more by a union of those two. Remember, that's the whole topic that kind of works its way through these verses. Because the first two of the three causes are compassion, great compassion, and the wisdom realizing emptiness. To some degree, we don't have that at the degree that a bodhisattva would have it further on the path. But if we already have some understanding that the reason why these beings are suffering is because they don't know the truth of reality, well, then we know that it can be attained because we've understood emptiness to some degree already, and we know that that can be realized, and therefore we're going to dedicate ourselves to bodhicitta, the third cause, which is to achieve the welfare of all beings by teaching them how to realize emptiness, motivated by our compassionate wish to benefit them, and to achieve enlightenment so we can do that perfectly. Okay? So that's the idea that we're moving in this direction. We start looking at what are the main things that cause a bodhisattva that then becomes a Buddha, that then helps these other beings to have their individual liberation and so on. All right. So I don't see any questions that came up in the chat box. Let me check and see, first with Donna, to see if there was there anything that came through. No? Would anyone like to ask a question? You can put it in the chat box if you don't want to come on screen, or have your voice on screen. So, anyone? How is the pace for this? Is everything going okay? I mean, I want to make sure I'm not going too fast or anything, but at the same time, there might be some of you who've had exposure to some of these topics who think I'm going too slow. So, anyone? Any comments on anything? No? Okay. Let's go back to the text for just a little bit then. If there's no other, there are no other questions or comments, what I'd like to do is get through maybe another paragraph or so. So again, this idea of these two, the object of attainment and the object of intent, being part and parcel of bodhicitta, which once more is that third cause of a bodhisattva. So it says here, however, Chandrakirti later shows in his commentary that bodhicitta, an altruistic mind of enlightenment, is generated in dependence on compassion. He says, one wishes to attain Buddhahood, which is the cause giving rise to the marvelous taste of ambrosia of the excellent doctrine, which is characterized by the disappearance of all wrong thoughts and which has the nature of being the friend of all beings. Thus, he clearly mentions taking cognizance of the object of attainment, even though, again, it wasn't present in those other comments. It was mostly looking at the object of intent of benefiting beings. It does recognize that you have to attain Buddhahood to do that. So he says that one's own enlightenment is definitely also something that one must have one's sight set on. You can't just have this motivation that is purely about, oh, I want all beings to realize emptiness, but I'm not going to realize emptiness in order to help them. You know, it doesn't make sense. We have to have both. Therefore, the complete definition of an altruistic mind generation is asserted to be the wish to attain highest enlightenment, the object of attainment, for the sake of all sentient beings, the objects of intent. As he says that this is in Jaya Ananda's commentary, he says that's good. He gives him a little pat on the shoulder here. He is not, you know, criticizing him. He says there's also no difference between what is said in Maitreya's ornament for clear realizations in this system. Essentially, Maitreya's ornament calls it mind generation, and it describes it as the desire for perfect, complete enlightenment for the welfare of others. So you always have those two kinds of aspects. And Tsongkhapa says here, you know, this that such appears in Jayananda's commentary is good. You know, it's good that people are identifying that bodhicitta requires both of those. Again, we'll continue with the text when we resume next week. But this idea of becoming a Buddha for the sake of others, before we conclude tonight, I'll use an example that I sometimes use. That's a more worldly example. But say you have a young girl who is dealing with a lot of people with cancer in her family for whatever reason, and she becomes very motivated by seeing her mother with breast cancer, and then maybe an aunt who dies of some cancer, and an uncle who dies of other cancer. She hears of all of this going on in her life, and she's still quite young and trying to decide what to do with her life. And she says, I want to help people with cancer because I've seen the suffering of cancer, and I know that I don't want them to suffer from that, and I know that I can help them if I, you know, if there are medicines and I could become an oncologist or a researcher or whatever. If she simply left it at that, it would be the object of intent only, right? Oh, I want to help all these people with cancer. She has to make the dedication to attaining the fully qualified person who can do that research or who can be an oncologist. She has to go through elementary school and go through high school and study science really well and then get into medical school and then do her internship and do all the things that I'm sure Robbie knows all about. All of the things involved in becoming a doctor, you know, so that you can then benefit others. If you don't do that, then you're never going to be able to achieve the object of intent. So this young girl, this example that I use, if she really wants to help people with cancer, she has to become qualified. And it's the same for the bodhisattva path. If we really want to help others to be free from their suffering, we have to become enlightened ourselves. Right now, we simply can't help others to the degree that they need help because we don't have the knowledge. We don't have the perfect understanding of their karma, their minds, what have you, which you will have when you attain Buddhahood and have that omniscient mind. Okay. All right. Let's do some dedication prayers. Sorry, I went kind of right to the line here. Okay. All right. Good. I was just checking what was in the chat box. Let me pull up the prayers. We're going to do the normal dedication prayers, usual dedication prayers that most of us do. The first one, dedicating all these merits we've created for complete enlightenment, an important part of our path as well, to make sure that none of it is wasted. And then in the second set of four lines, recalling bodhicitta and how important it is that this mind grow and develop in our own hearts and in the hearts of all beings. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Then the prayers for our precious teachers, His Holiness, who had his 86th birthday earlier this week, make strong prayers for him, as well as Lama Zopa Rinpoche, as well as Tenzin Asalhita, Lama Yeshe's reincarnation. As you recite prayers for these three beings, extend this out to all spiritual guides in all traditions, so that we and others continue to benefit from their guiding presence. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Venerable One, to you whose kindness exceeds that of all the conquerors, for those wanderers in far-off places, especially the West, mindful of your loving concern for us and intentionally descending again into a family of a far distant land, we make this request. O Lama, please, please live long. And we also dedicate very quickly for those beings that we're holding in our hearts right now. There are beings that we know of who are experiencing illness, obstacles, who are dying or who have died. And there are also others whose situation moves us at this time. So we can think about those beings and send this positive energy out to them. Because they are sort of a link with us in generating our compassion, we want them to experience the full benefits of what we've done, be free from all their suffering instantly, and find all the causes that lead them to true happiness. And may this be so for all beings. Thank you so much for joining again tonight, and I'll look forward to the next class. And again, what we will do from here, continue with this little portion on the three causes of a bodhisattva. But then again, we're singling out compassion as the root one, and we're going to go into a wonderful verse that talks about the importance of compassion in the beginning of our practice, in the middle of our practice, in the end of our practice, in terms of the culmination in Buddhahood. And it's a really inspiring little section. And then we go on to the three types of compassion, where we'll get an even closer view of how we unite the wisdom aspects of the Buddha's teachings with that great compassion. Terrific, everyone. Hang in there. Be well. And I will see you again next week. Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks.